Today, Under the Hood, the DFA Daily to the 30th July 2020. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest posts covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour and with a touch of philosophy on the side. The government funding arm, the AOFM, has just completed their longest ever syndication, issuing $15 billion of a new 30-year bond. The 1.75% 21 November 2015 bond was priced at the tight end of the initial 98 to 105 basis point, 10-year range, and has performed by around 3 basis points since it was issued. The book was just over $36 billion in size, which is almost three times the amount of bids the AFM attracted for their first 30-year syndication, a March 2047 issued back in October 2016. The transaction was less covered than the AFM's two most recent issues, but is still elevated by historical standards, and especially so for an ultra-long bond. Westpac says this is the AFM's second syndication in the 30-year part of the curve, so direct comparisons aren't abundant. However, the investor breakdown by both region and type is consistent with the March 47 bond as well. The AFM awarded offshore investors 66.9% of the transaction, almost twice the overall average of 36%. That is, in fact, the highest ever allocation offshore, demonstrating that despite historically low absolute yields, on a relative basis, Australia continues to provide a high-yielding, highly rated opportunity for the global investor. Now, the allocation for the November 25 bond showed there was a growing demand from Asia, apart from Japan, which is also evident in this transaction. Despite receiving a lower allocation than the past four syndications, the 13% cut to Asia excluding Japan is double that of the March 47 bond and has absorbed some of the Japanese bid. Fund managers represented the largest investor cohort, taking down almost 70% of the deal. And we didn't receive a breakdown between asset managers and insurance companies, but it would be expected that insurance companies would especially value the longer duration of the bond, and this is somewhat corroborated by high participation rates from the UK. The relatively small allocation to balance sheets and central banks was to be expected given the bond's ultra-long tenor. Overall, Westpac thinks the syndication was a good result and provides further confidence in the strength of demand for Australian government debt. The AFM's issuance strategy was a strong positive for the March 47 in its initial months, with the spread between it and the next longest bond narrowing rapidly, even as the 3- to 10-year curve was steepening in the months following the new issuance. That has started to play out again, with the new June 51 tightening around 2 basis points since Tuesday's close. Again, that informs Westpac's view that the 10 to 30 year curve should not steepen too much from current levels. Having ticked the 2025 and 2051 off their list, the AFM now have announced an intention to establish new ACGB bond lines maturing in 2026, 2031, and 2032 by syndication in 2021. In the meantime, they expect issuance via tender to continue at a rate of around $4 to $5 billion in most weeks. Now, total dwelling approvals fell 4.9% to be down nearly 20% over the last 2 months, touching an 8-year low in seasonally adjusted terms, according to data released by the ABS today. The impact of COVID-19 was evident in dwelling approvals. Falls were recorded in all states and across both detached and attached dwellings. In seasonally adjusted terms, private sector houses fell 5.7% in June, while private sector dwellings, excluding houses, fell 5.3%. Double-digit falls were recorded in New South Wales at 14.8%, Western Australia at 11.7%, Queensland at 10.9%, and Tasmania at 10.8%, while South Australia at 4.6% and Victoria at 0.2% also declined. And approvals for private sector houses fell in Queensland, down 15.2%, New South Wales, down 11.3%, South Australia, down 2.23%, and Western Australia, down 0.8%, while Victoria rose slightly, up 0.9%, in seasonally adjusted terms. And the value of total buildings approved rose 7.3% in June in seasonally adjusted terms. The value of non-residential building rose 17.8%, while residential building rose 0.1%. The latter was buoyed by an 11.4% increase in the value of alterations and additions to residential buildings. But fear not, because the Morrison government is expected to expand its first home buyer deposit subsidy scheme in the October budget. The National Housing Finance and Investment Corporation released data today that showed since July the 1st, 4,076 places have been reserved or processed under the First Home Loan Deposit Scheme. The rapid take-up of the scheme's allocated places, which helps applicants purchase a home with a deposit of as low as 5%, will buoy the real estate industry, which has been hard hit, of course, by falling property prices, depressed rents, and poor auction clearance numbers during the pandemic. Mr. Sukha told The Australian the government was, quote, committed to doing all we can to help Australians get into a home of their own sooner. By delivering our loan guarantees, we are helping Australians cut years off the time it takes to save, as first-time buyers can now purchase a home with a deposit as little as 5%, he said. The data shows buyer confidence is being maintained, with the recently released tranche of guarantees being eagerly secured. And The Australian understands the surge in applications is likely to trigger an expansion of the loan guarantee program ahead of the October budget. As at Monday, 279 applications had been approved and a further 3,797 places put on hold, with the average income of applicants at $57,668 for singles and $94,094 for couples, well below the scheme's $125,000 and $200,000 salary caps. Well, I suppose the first-time buyer bribes will help some property investors to escape with their shirts, but really, is this any way to run a country? The data continues to deteriorate for Australia's army of negatively geared landlords. The Australian Bureau of Statistics also reporting that capital city property rents declined by a record 1.3% over the June quarter and by 1.2% over the year. The fact is that many of these first-time buyers will be coming into the market at precisely the wrong time, buying when prices are on the way down, and frankly being committed to loan repayments that, given rising unemployment, will be hard to maintain. Now, this is just nuts. Now, the government expects around $42 billion to be removed from the super scheme as a result of the earlier release scheme, having revised up its initial estimates of $27 billion at the start of the scheme by $15 billion. I wonder how much of that money is going directly into deposits for first-time buyers. Nobody quite knows, but I suspect it's in there. Treasury Division Head of Retirement Income Policy, Robert Jeremenko, told the Senate Committee on COVID-19 that the government is now expecting $41.9 billion to be removed from the super system following the extension of the scheme to December and taking into account lived experience of the pandemic, which indicates consumers had taken up the scheme in higher numbers than expected. The early access measure was developed in early March, and I don't think anyone in Australia would have been able to predict what the impact of the pandemic was, he said. What we had to do was to use our best estimate, but the actual lived experience of those first 3 months up to the 30th of June was actually, we had 20.1 billion removed. So what we did was, given the extra 3 months of actual numbers, assumed a certain take-up for the remaining 3 months plus the extensions. And he said that as at the 28th of July, $31.9 billion had been withdrawn from super. And he added the Treasury would revise up the expected withdrawal numbers further, depending on how many more consumers accessed the scheme. This 6 months we are now in, they are estimates, they are best estimates, but we will revise as we have done when we see actual numbers coming through, and that will give us a real feel for the level of uptake, he said. Now, Commonwealth Bank's full-year profit will take an additional $300 million hit as the size of the bill to refund customers of the bank's financial planning arm, and the associated program costs swelled to $834 million. The new figure represents the bank's best estimate to bring the fees for no service scandal among its aligned advisors to a close. The scandal was scrutinized during the Hayne Royal Commission, where CBA was described as a gold medalist in charging fees it was not entitled to. CBA's total provisions for aligned advisors, as well as those who operated under its license but were not employed by it, include $698 million to refund a little more than one third of all customers charged continuing service fees over a decade, and a further $136 million in program costs. The additional cost will be recognised in the bank's full-year results due on August the 12th. The results will be closely watched by investors and analysts alike, who have been forced to recalibrate expectations for a bumper second-half dividend following guidance from the prudential regulator to moderate distributions and cap the payout ratio at no more than 50%. And the uncertain speed of the global economic recovery from the crisis sparked the coronavirus pandemic has left Macquarie Group unable to give meaningful guidance on its earnings after the company revealed its first quarter results were slightly down on prior years. In an update on its business performance ahead of its annual general meeting on Thursday, Macquarie said its asset management arm had increased earnings compared with the same time last year because of the sale of its rail operating lease businesses in April, while its banking arm was stung by higher provisions for sourcing loans. Macquarie had recently posted an 8.4% drop in full-year profit to $2.7 billion and a final dividend reduced by half, and warned the economic recovery was unlikely to be V-shaped. The bounce back was going to be much more drawn out. Its market-facing businesses were hampered by significantly lower investment-related income in the Macquarie Capital business, which were partly offset by healthier results in its commodities units. Macquarie's chief executive said the company remained, quote, well-positioned to deliver performance over the medium term and would adapt its operations to changing market conditions. Macquarie's asset management, which contributes 40% of earnings, was hurt by a 5% fall in assets to $568 billion, driven by mostly currency movements. The division, which operates an aviation finance investment business, is also working with airlines to provide relief for grounded airlines. Macquarie said 13% of its banking and finance clients were accessing support at the end of June. And in the markets business, clients seeking out hedging and trading opportunities on Macquarie's commodities platform have boosted earnings, along with clients seeking to rebalance portfolios to manage risks in the volatile environment. Macquarie Capital suffered a fall in fee revenue as merger and acquisition slowed, with challenging markets expected to reduce the number of successful transactions and increase the time for completion. Macquarie warned investment-related income was expected to be significantly down on fiscal 2020, given the slowdown in the sale of assets, but the group was confident that it would be able to take advantage of the market recovery. And the group spruiked its healthy capital position a day after the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority requested banks and insurers to limit dividends to 50% of profits, given the continued uncertainty in the economy, and flagged it had surplus capital at $8.1 billion at the end of June. Market conditions are likely to remain challenging, especially given the significant unprecedented uncertainty caused by the worldwide impact of COVID-19 and the uncertainty and speed of the global economic recovery, Macquarie said. The extent to which these conditions will adversely impact our overall financial year 21 profitability is uncertain, making short-term forecasting extremely difficult. Accordingly, we are currently unable to provide meaningful earnings guidance for the year ahead. And over at NAB, they said it would change the way it runs more than 100 of its smaller regional branches, only opening them between 9:30 a.m. and lunchtime for customers, and moving to phone or online banking in the afternoon. The change, which will come into effect on the 17th of August, will see bankers splitting their time between over-the-counter service and digital or phone banking support. According to the bank, more than 90% of NAB's customers' interactions are now taking place online or by phone, and more than half of its customers log onto its NAB banking app or online each month. It added that over-the-counter transactions have been declining steadily and have reduced by a quarter in the past year, Further, the bank noted that approximately one quarter of transactions take place between 9:30 and 10:30 a.m. in regional branches. NABS Group Executive Personal Banking Rachel Slade said, "It was clear the face of banking is changing, especially in the way customers want to interact with us. Through this new model, we can continue to be there to serve our customers and have meaningful conversations while also adapting to the way our customers now want banking." Moreover, the bank noted that many bankers had reskilled into remote banking during the COVID-19 restrictions and demonstrated that there was an opportunity for bankers to work remotely at times. Slade said, "Our colleagues will learn new skills to support customers in new ways, including on the phone and online chat, which presents the opportunity for our bankers to work remotely at times when more of our customers want to do their banking. We have shown this is possible through COVID-19 restrictions, with more than 450 bankers trained in new skills to support customers in different ways. The chance for more of our bankers to work from anywhere is something I'm very excited about. We think this move will strike that balance, keeping the doors open at 114 branches around the country and providing the opportunity for around 300 bankers to learn skills while we continue to serve our customers well. We are there for our regional customers and communities, and we will continue to invest in our colleagues to give them the skills they need to do their jobs into the future," she concluded. And finally, the Fed is beloved by some for averting a crippling financial crisis in March and then for keeping its foot to the pedal enough to virtually erase all the stock market losses. It's already loathed by many who think it has gone way too far and that inflation and currency debasement lie in our future. Just look at gold. Now, at an all-time high in dollar terms, of course. On Wednesday, at least, Chairman Jerome Powell did a masterly job of meeting market expectations of a non-event. As expected, there were no significant announcements. The statement was unchanged except to emphasise that the Fed is captive to the coronavirus. The only important change was the addition of this sentence: "The path of the economy will depend significantly on the course of the virus." This, it seems to me, is already a strong candidate for the title of most uncontroversial sentence a Fed chairman has ever uttered. In the press conference, and again as expected, all the emphasis was on the word fiscal. The Fed has lifted markets almost single-handedly, much as it did after the 2008 crisis. It cannot perform the same trick on the economy without the help from fiscal policy, which was a lesson from the GFC, and of course from public health authorities. Powell wanted everyone to grasp that there were limits to what he could do without assistance from elected politicians. And of course, he is right about this. Debates over resorting to yield curve control or to do a more aggressive form of forward guidance will continue. And there is a good chance that we will hear more on these possibilities at the next meeting in September. But as it stands, the package was enough to keep real yields and the dollar heading down and stocks and gold heading up. In all cases, the moves weren't dramatic, but what really matters to these markets, as Powell said, is villa number one, the virus. Until that's under control, all bets are off, and if that's true in the US, it's also true here in Australia. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.